8:34 in the morning, you're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiegert. Kat Brooks is out this week, but she is with us on tape. Before she left town, she recorded an interview with Albert Woodfox, who enjoys the dubious distinction of having served the longest period of solitary confinement in U.S. prison history at Angola State Prison in Louisiana. He was released in 2016. He's just out with a new memoir entitled Solitary. Let's go back to their conversation.
You talk about in the book also, though, that sort of the suppression of your emotions, that not allowing yourself to feel certain things while you were in solitary.
Yeah. Well, you know, being a student, you know, I had become a student of African-American history. I became an avaricious reader, you know, and I used to read about, you know, how families were torn apart during child slavery and the brutality that went with being a slave and stuff. And so as a means of protection, you know, African-American, my ancestor didn't allow themselves to get too emotionally attached. Of course, it didn't work out that way, but at least there was a valiant effort on their part not to become attached to anything or anyone, because they knew that at any moment it could be taken away from them. And so the pain of having something that means so much to you taken away from you without reason, without cause, without justification, it's a very painful experience. So I went through this period where, you know, I would only allow myself to become emotionally attached to any individual or any, I guess you could say, any privilege or right that existed in prison, because I knew it could be taken away from me at any moment. And so I began to understand what my ancestors went through during child slavery and on up until the 70s. You know, I began to understand where some of the reactions to what was going on in their personal lives, their neighborhoods, at their cities, or in the country as a whole, you know. And one of the things that came from that is I made a solemn vow to myself that I would never allow myself to feel worthless again. I would never allow myself to feel powerless, you know, and that I would stand and fight against anything that I thought was wrong or corrupt or brutal or whatever, which, you know, was a motivating factor. And all of this came about because of my membership in the party and required reading and a level of consciousness. So when Harmony and I were put in solitary confinement, and Robert, who was 100-something miles away when Officer Miller had been killed, but yet was placed in solitary under an investigation because he was a member of the Black Panther Party as well. So when we were placed in solitary confinement, I was not just another prisoner. I was not, you know, wired into the prison culture, but I was a political prisoner. I consider myself to be a political victim and a political prisoner because of my political beliefs. And so I had a foundation that allowed me to not turn away from society, but to turn towards society and let what was going on in society be the influence that, you know, shape my moral principles, my values, my code of conduct, and how I saw myself as an individual and how I saw society as a whole, as opposed to turning inwardly and become what's called institutionalized, in which you turn your back on society and you become immersed in the prison culture. So it was a conscious decision on my part, Harmon and Robert's part, to try to stay connected to society, because we still had family and friends who were a part of society and who were affected by whatever happened, you know, in society. And so that, you know, that gave us a purpose other than prison culture.
Mm-hmm. You are talking about Herman Wallace and Robert King, who ultimately, along with you, would become known as the Angola Three.
Yes.
You all, so to that point, Mr. Woodfox, when you're talking about that you'd made a decision that if it was wrong, you were going to call it out and that you weren't going to allow anybody to do anything to you that was unjust, you all engaged in, you weren't just in solitary confinement sitting down, you all engaged in decades of resistance. Lawsuits and organizing prison, other folks that were incarcerated on the tiers. Talk about that and how prison officials would respond when y'all would organize these acts of resistance.
Well, when we I was placed in solitary confinement April 18th. Brent Miller, I was picked up for Brent Miller's murder April 17th. And the next day, I was placed in a dungeon, and of course, I was beaten and threatened, and even the Miller brothers came up to. They had me isolated in the shower instead of in the cell with someone else, for the purpose where I would be, wouldn't have any help if they decide to, to jump me and beat me down. And so, as I said, from April 18, 1972 to February 19, which is my birthday, 2016, I was in solitary confinement with brief periods of being out of solitary confinement, not out of, I should say out of the cells, because in 2008, Robin and King and I had filed a civil suit in 2000 challenging long-term cell confinement. And it was the second suit we had filed. And eventually we got some very good lawyers who took the case over pro bono. So the case got real serious. To try to undermine the merits of the case, the prison DOC or Department of Correction, they opened up a dormitory in 2008. And at first, Harmon and I were not on the list to be transferred to that. But Congressman John Conyers and a state representative who's a U.S. congressman now, Cedric Richmond, read about the case, heard about the case, and knew something was wrong. That two men had been locked up that long. Robert was out by that time. He spent 29 years out of 32 years in solitary confinement for investigation for a murder that occurred when he wasn't even in the prison. And so once John Conyers and Congressman Richmond came to Angola along with other members of Congress, staff rather. They came on a Thursday, and that Monday, Herman and I was in this dormitory. But it was still isolated. It was like a bigger cell. We went from a 9x6 cell to a dormitory. We were still isolated. We weren't allowed to integrate or interact with the prison population. We didn't even eat with them. We had our own specific time when we went to eat. And then in 1996, when I discharged on my original sentence, which is 50 years for armed robbery, I was transferred to Amid City, which is a Tangipahoa parish in Louisiana, for retrial on the Brent Miller murder. My case had been overturned because of a writ that Robert Hillary King had filed. And so I was granted a new trial. And so once I finished my prison sentence, I was transferred there where I remained for like 2 years and something, going through the legal process of a trial.
Let's talk about the accusation that y'all killed Brent Miller, there was no evidence that pointed to you, Herman, King, at all.
Well, there was evidence that strongly pointed to the fact that we were innocent. I mean, there was a bloody fingerprint found on the door in Mr. Miller's blood that did not match any of us. The men charged didn't match any of the people who worked the crime scene. And there were other, you know, bloody partial prints and stuff around the dorm. Mr. Miller would have been stabbed 32 times. I think he must have put up a tremendous struggle. And so I would assume. But once the fingerprints didn't match us, the state stopped looking. They were no longer, as far as they were concerned, they had the guys who did it. And they were satisfied, never mind the fact that, we were members of the Black Panther Party. We had been active in the prison organizing against corruption and brutality and murder and rape, which was probably the real reason why we became the prime suspects, even though evidence suggests, even though there were witnesses who said that the time that Mr. Miller was killed, either they were in a dormitory with me or they ate in a dining hall with me. And so, but even now, the prison people know who that bloody fingerprint is. And for whatever reason, they decided, to cover it up. And it was strange because right before I was released, the court had just ordered them to compare that bloody fingerprint to all the fingerprints of the people who worked there or who were prisoners in Angola in 1972. My release came about a plea bargain called Nola Contenda, in which you don't plead guilty to the charge. You're just saying that the state has enough evidence to bring you to trial. And so, as a result of that, I was released with time served. They broke the charge down from murder to manslaughter, which was totally ridiculous. And they added another charge, which was, otherwise, they were covering their ass. They wanted to make sure that they could justify holding us in prison, in solitary confinement for that length of time. They knew that they were very liable to civil action that we had filed because of the fact they had held us in solitary confinement for so long, in spite of evidence overwhelmingly suggesting that, we were the wrong men. And they opened this dormitory, as I said. And in theory, you were supposed to go there and adjust to being in population, and then they release you into population. But it never was that. It was just an attempt by the state to undermine the merits of our civil action. And as I said, while we were in this dormitory, we were always separated from other prisoners. We ate alone. The only time we were allowed to mingle was on visiting day. And, it was the first time that I was in a position where I could see, the moon or the stars at night. It was the first time Herman and I had been allowed to be in live in the same area on a constant basis for 30 years or more. So it was a lot of freedom, but we were never, ever allowed back in the prison population. As you probably know, we lost Herman 3 days after his case was overturned in 41 to liver cancer.
And I'm sorry for your loss. After 44 years of solitary confinement and fighting the Brent Miller case, asserting your innocence, ultimately, what made you decide to take the plea deal, and how hard was that for you to do?
Well, it was very hard because for 40-something years, I had always been an example of resistance, a re-example of strength and fight. And, you know, so I saw, even though I wasn't pleading guilty to Brent Miller's murder, still I was, you know, I felt as though I was competent. It's a decision. Look, I'm happy I'm free now. You know, I've been able to do so much more for what I believe in. But still there are times, it's particularly when I'm here at the house by myself, I have moments in which, you know, I get very angry and irritated, you know, with myself because, you know, or taking this plea deal. You know, what ultimately, you know, caused me to take the plea, it was a lot of things, you know. The age fact, I had been locked up 44 years and 10 months in solitary confinement. But I think it was a conversation that I had with my brother that weighed the heaviest. And it was, you know, my daughter had broke down and crying one time when he was visiting with her. And she said, I don't have a daddy, you know. And he's like, well, you have a daddy. I think you'd be very proud of what your daddy has accomplished, even though he's in prison. And she said, yeah, but I don't know what it feels like for my daddy to hold me in his arms. Or I don't know what it feels like to call it, you know, say daddy and get a response. You know, it's just so much missing, you know, from my life. And I think that was, after struggling, you know, 6 months or more, I think that was the final factor that tipped the scale and, you know, made me take the plea deal and so I could come home. You know, I had, you know, 4 beautiful great-grandkids and 3 grandkids who were adults. And so, you know, all of those factors, my biggest worries were how would my family perceive me now? Would they accept me? And would my community accept me after doing so much harm and damage to my own people, my own community? And I think that I've made a successful transition on both of those issues.
We have just a few minutes before I have to let you go, though I could talk to you for several more hours. But what is your life like now? What are you doing with your days now?
Well, I'm a committed social activist. I'm determined to stop the use of solitary confinement as a prison tool. And there are other issues, legalized slavery under the 13th Amendment, just social issues and general and particular. Of course, we're mostly known for surviving decades in solitary confinement, not just surviving, but, becoming better human beings, becoming educated, teaching ourselves the law, criminal and civil law, challenge successfully issues, in the prison, particularly in solitary confinement. And so that's pretty much, you know, now I've written a book, as you know, called Solitary, because I think, you know, this book, what it does is it gives me an opportunity to reach more people. You know, I'm 72 years old now, although I'm in great health. No matter how many speaking engagements, and I've spoken across America and Europe, I will never be able to meet as many people as I would with this book. You know, there's a possibility that I think the book is in its second printing now. It's selling well. So, you know, that gives me an opportunity to reach more people and hopefully raise their level of consciousness. You know, what life has taught me is that an individual or an event can raise your level of consciousness. Once your level of consciousness is raised, then you will form a moral principle. What you do from that point on takes great courage. You know, one of the most difficult things for human beings is to accept change, and it is the most necessary thing in order to survive. But change represents new challenges, unfamiliar territory, for lack of a better word. And so we fight against change, even when we know it's harmful to us. So, you know, what Robin and I are doing, you know, is we're trying to start a national and an international debate about the brutality of the way prisons are, about the horror of using solitary confinement as a means of punishment and destruction, and the social issues that exist in this country, you know. One of the things I remember when I got out, and, you know, in my exposure to society, real society, was, you know, TVs and magazines and newspapers, which we had to fight for decades to get in solitary confinement, how much had society, you know, I've been hearing how much society had changed, and we had elected a black president, and blah. And then to get out and to see that nothing had really changed, not deep roots. The roots in change in America were superficial. They had no roots. And for order for something to grow, it needs roots. And that the brutality of the racism when I left society were not coded words, nice words, but still with the same meaning, same belief. And so, you know, I realized, you know, that my personal motivation is my grandbabies, you know. I would not want to see them 30 years from now giving an interview to someone about their political or personal views and fighting the same issues. And that was one of the biggest shocks when I got out, to realize that after almost 50 years of being locked away from society and all these wonderful changes that people talked about and some of the events that had happened, that nothing had really changed. America was, is, and still as racist as it was when I left society in 1969. And then we have a situation where a white supremacist becomes president of the United States and openly express white supremacist views and practices and abuses. And you know, so, you know, the vows that I made to fight for humanity in a 9x6 prison cell are the vows that I'm trying to live my life by now. And that means fighting for social change.
Mr. Albert Woodfox, thank you so much for joining me this morning. And thank you for your work.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity.
Absolutely. Anytime you want to come on our show, you just let us know. You're always welcome.
Okay. I'll keep that in mind. Thank you.
Thank you. You are listening to Upfront. I have been speaking with Albert Woodfox about his new book, Solitary, which chronicles the 40 years he spent in solitary confinement, mostly at Angola Prison in Louisiana, the former slave plantation that's notorious for its violence against prisoners. The book covers from his early years as a child in New Orleans, Louisiana, and chronicles the entire 40-plus years he was in solitary, all of the struggles, the resistance, the ultimate community and worldwide support, and then his release.
And that does it for today's show. Upfront airs weekday mornings at 7 a.m. We post information about our topics and our guests online at kpfa.org. If you want to get in touch, suggest something for us to cover, or someone for us to interview, send an email to upfront@kpfa.org. A big thanks to everyone who makes the show happen. Our producer is Corinne Smith. Our engineer is Kirsten Thomas. Hosts are me, Brian Edwards-Tiekert, Kat Brooks, who you just heard. She'll be back live next week. And Janina Etter on Fridays. A big thanks to the other folks who make the show happen. Our engineer is Kirsten Thomas. Our producer is Corinne Smith. Our interns are on a sheet of paper I have misplaced at the moment. Apologies, guys. Justin Gold, Casey Repke, and Elizabeth Soule. The big thanks as well to Mitch Jezerich and Eileen Alfandari. And if you're behind bars and want to get in touch and don't have access to email, you can send a letter to Upfront, KPFA, 1929 Martin Luther King Jr. Way, Berkeley, California, 94703. Stay up and stay tuned for Democracy Now! At 9 a.m.